This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for March 2011. Well, we've still got quite long night times, which is good for astronomers. As night falls, Orion and the lovely constellations like Taurus, the Bull, are nearby, but they're beginning to set towards the west. And as the night moves on, perhaps we should now move our eyes towards the constellations that we haven't been able to see so well for a while. Perhaps first of those is the constellation of Gemini, the heavenly twins, which is up to the left of Orion, and that'll be seen in the southwest, sort of in the mid-evening. Its two brightest stars are Castor and Pollux. If you've got binoculars and on a dark night, if you follow down to the feet of the uppermost twin that has Castor at its head, and look a little bit to the right-hand side, you might spot the rather lovely open cluster called M35. As you move across from Gemini towards the east, there's a fairly empty part of the sky, but in the center there is the constellation of Cancer the Crab. And again, with binoculars, you can see a rather lovely wide open cluster. It's called M44, or the Prisipi, the beehive cluster, several names for it, and that's very close to the not particularly bright star at the heart of the constellation of Cancer. And as you keep going, you then come to the sickle of Leo the Lion, and that's one of the few constellations, in my view, actually looks like what it says it is. It's rather like the lions in Trafalgar Square on their haunches. Regulus is the brightest star, Alpha Leonis, and that's sort of the four paws, if you like, or at least the knees of the lion, the front knees. The sickle makes up his head, and then you can actually see the body of the lion going back to a star called Denebola, which basically forms his tail. That's quite a nice region where, with a small telescope, you can actually pick up some galaxies. If you actually start at Regulus and you basically move horizontally when it's in the south, you may well be able to spot a couple of nice galaxies, M95, M96, and further over, M65 and M66. So they're both nice things to see and relatively easy to find. Over to the lower left of Leo in the evening is rising the constellation of Virgo. Again, it doesn't have many bright stars. Spica, Alpha Virginis, is the brightest. But between Leo and Virgo, and below a little constellation called Coma Berenices, is an area of the sky they call the realm of the galaxies. And this is looking towards what we call the Virgo cluster, a cluster of well over 1,000 galaxies. And in there are quite a number of galaxies in the so-called Messier catalogue, which means on a good dark night with a transparent sky, you could see them with a relatively small telescope. I think Messier only had a telescope about 3.5 to 4 inches aperture. So that's a lovely region to look, but you've got to have a dark, transparent sky to see them. Now, high overhead, perhaps seen as its best all year, we have the constellation of Ursa Major, the Great Bear, and within that, of course, we have the asterism, I suppose, that we call the plough, or the Americans call the Big Dipper, which I always used to think was one of these sort of fairground rides, but in fact, it's actually the ladle that farmers' wives used to ladle out the broth at lunchtime for the farmhands. The two right-hand stars of the plough, Merrick at the bottom and Dubhe at the top, they point across to Polaris, the pole star, the northern star. A nice thing to look at with binoculars is the central star of the three that make up the handle of the plough, called Alcor and Mizar. And in fact, you'll easily see there's a double there with binoculars, and possibly even just with your eyes, if you've got very good eyesight. With a small telescope, it's rather nice because the brighter of them is seen to be a double itself. So you've got three stars visible. And then there's actually a rather fainter reddish star that sort of makes an open triangle with them. So there's a lot to see in the sky in the next few weeks, and we still have a good number of hours to see them with. So let's have a look at the planets that we can see this month. The first one I think to mention is Jupiter. It's now coming to the end of its current apparition. That's the period of time when we see it well. But you can still see it low in the west after sunset, at the beginning of the month. And I've got that coming up in a highlight later on. But to be honest, by the end of the month, it'll have been swallowed up in the sunset glare. Still got a magnitude of minus 2.1, so it's pretty bright. And its angular size doesn't vary an awful lot. It's now about 33.5 arc seconds. So given a small telescope, you should easily see the moons of Jupiter weaving their way around it and some of the markings on the surface. But of course, when it's low down, the atmosphere will tend to degrade the image somewhat. There's a thin, waxing crescent moon passing very close to Jupiter on the 6th of the month. I'll come back to that briefly. Well, now Saturn is beginning to come to the best part of its current apparition. It's now becoming an evening object. Rises at about 2100 hours UT at the beginning of March and about 2000 UT by the end. It's due south and highest in the sky at about 3 o'clock at the beginning of the month, and by 1 o'clock BST, remembering the clocks change before the very end of the month, by its end. So we're beginning to have a good look at Saturn. It starts March with a magnitude of plus 0.5. It's a bit brighter than it was a year or so ago because the rings are now opening out. They went out to about 10 degrees to edge on, but just because of the way the Earth moves around the Sun as well, they've actually dropped back a bit, and they're currently this month at about 9 degrees edge on. The rings span an angular size of about 42 arc seconds, and so there's just a chance now that because they've opened out, you can actually see what's called Cassini's division, which is a rather dark ring you see separating two of the bands of the rings. Another highlight of Saturn to come up later on. Mercury, I'll come to that as a highlight because it's one of its good apparitions this month. Mars, well, it's lying behind the Sun, so that won't be visible. And finally, Venus. Well, it remains a pre-dawn object, shining at about minus 4.1, and that's pretty bright. It rises at about 5:30 a.m., an hour before sunrise, so you've still got a chance to see it. But although its angular separation from the Sun is still quite large, because the ecliptic is coming at a lower angle to the horizon than it was some months ago, it's actually not that high in the sky. So you've got to have a good eastern horizon to see it. As it's moving towards the far side of the Sun, its angular size is getting less. It starts the month at 15.4 arc seconds, drops to 13.7. But at the same time, the amount of the surface that we see illuminated by the Sun is increasing. And those two effects tend to cancel out, so the brightness basically stays pretty constant. But by the end of the month, that's going to be lost in the Sun's glare as well. So next month, we certainly shan't see Jupiter, and we won't see Venus either. Okay, well, finally, let's just have a look at some of the highlights of this month. Well, I left out Mercury because it really is a highlight. It's at its best this spring. We normally see Mercury well twice a year, once in the spring and once in the autumn. In the springtime, we see it in the evening best, and that's because the ecliptic in March basically is at a fairly steep angle to the horizon, so even though Mercury isn't all that far away from the Sun in angle, it's still fairly high up in the sky. It might just be visible around the 5th of March with a magnitude of minus 1.4, but it would need a very good low western horizon to see it, and it's pretty well due west at that time. But of course, if you're looking with binoculars, wait until the Sun has set. You don't want to look anywhere close to the Sun with any form of visual aid. That evening, on the 5th, is when there'll be a very, very thin crescent moon, just 5 degrees to its right. If you can spot that, you're doing jolly well. The day later, the moon might be easier to see. As the month progresses, it increases its angular separation from the Sun, but also, in fact, she gets somewhat less bright. Its so-called greatest eastern elongation, and that's when its angle is furthest from the Sun, is on the 23rd of March. But by then, its brightness will have dropped to magnitude plus 0.4, but it will be relatively high in the sky. On the 23rd of the month, you might just spot Jupiter directly below, just above the horizon, if you've got a very good low western horizon. It might be the last time you have a chance to see Jupiter before it appears again in the morning sky. I've mentioned March the 6th, sunset. You have Jupiter and a thin crescent moon lying above Mercury. That Mercury will still be very low, you may not spot that, but it'd be very nice to see Jupiter and the moon not too far apart. Mercury would be 9 degrees below the moon, almost exactly below due west. As a little diagram in the night sky page, just put that into Google, will show you. And on March the 15th, again Mercury, we have a very nice close encounter of Jupiter and Mercury. And they'll be just about 2 degrees apart. So very easy to spot the pair of them. Binoculars will easily show them in the same field of view, as will a relatively low power telescope. That might be nice to see. Now, occasionally, I talk about seeing the moon occult a star, what we call a lunar occultation. There was one last month in the early morning. But this month, there's a slightly brighter star being occulted, and also it's in the evening, at about 9:07, on the evening of the 13th of March. This time, it's the third magnitude star, so quite bright, called Eta Geminorum, and that will be occulted by the leading and hence dark limb of the moon. So it'd be rather nice to look at that and see it disappear in the twinkling of an eye. You have to try and judge when that's going to happen by imagining the full circle of the moon. So at the time, just keep your eyes open. It will be about 21:07 in the mid-UK, but it does vary a bit depending where you are. So you can't be too precise about that. It's going to reappear equally quickly, but this time from a bright limb, about an hour later at 22:07. That might be worth looking for if it's a clear night. I tried to include one or two things that you can see with a small telescope in the hope of encouraging you to buy one, and I hope many of you have. Saturn's moons are nice to see, and you have really to try when the moon is not really around, because although you can generally see Titan the brightest at about magnitude 8, given a dark, transparent sky, you should easily pick up three others, Dione, Rhea, and Tethys. I chose the 1st and 2nd of March to have a look because there's no moon, essentially, and they're all quite tightly clustered close to Saturn. So you can use quite a high power magnification, which actually helps see the fainter objects and see Titan over to the right and the other three moons closer in. But of course, any time when there's no real moon, you have a chance to see it. The program called Stellarium, just put that into Google, will show you every night where those satellites will be seen relative to Saturn. Just home in on Saturn and zoom right in, and you see all the satellites you can pick up. So that's something nice to see, and I've certainly photographed them on occasions and seen them. And finally, on the moon, there's a very nice feature that you can see just after first quarter, or just before third quarter, and that's about March the 13th and March the 25th, it's called the straight wall. To be honest, it's not really a wall, it's a scarp, but it looks like a fairly straight line, and in one case you see it as a dark shadow, and in the other case you see it as lit up as a bright line against the maria in which it's in. In fact, Sir Patrick Moore said, neither is it a wall, nor is it straight. It's basically a gentle scarp, but it's one of the nice features to spot with a small telescope on the moon's surface. So good hunting for March.
Thanks for that, Ian. And here's John Fields to tell us what you can see in the southern sky this month.
Kia ora and welcome to the Carter Observatory's March night sky. March sees our summer constellations of Taurus, Orion and Gemini sliding towards the western sky a little more each evening. Our nights are quickly becoming longer and this means more opportunity for stargazing. In the west, the Pleiades Matariki set earlier each evening and will soon be lost in the twilight. They will return in our morning sky, however, at the time of our winter solstice. The Pleiades form the prow of a great canoe in the night sky that was used by Tamariri to sail across the heavens, placing Nafetu, the stars, into the sky. One version of this canoe uses the Pleiades to mark the prow, and then the V-shape of the Hyades cluster in Taurus to form the sail, Orion's belt and sword form the stern and carved sternpost of the canoe. The V-shaped head of Taurus consists of a distant cluster of stars, the half-sister of the Pleiades forming a distinct V, along with a much closer and brighter star, Aldebaran, forming one of the bull's eyes. The name Aldebaran originates from the Arabic word, the follower, as this star follows the Pleiades across the sky. Aldebaran has a distinct orange hue, and this is a K5 type star that is 65 light years away from us and 150 times brighter than our star, the Sun. This star has used up all its hydrogen fuel at its core and is fusing hydrogen in a shell around it. The star's radius has increased to 44 times that of our Sun, and with a much larger surface area, the surface temperature has dropped to around 4,000 degrees. The spectral type of a star is based on its spectral lines and temperatures. Today they fall into the following sequence: O, B, A, F, G, K, and M, running from hottest to coolest. This can be remembered by the term, O be a fine girl, or guy, kiss me. Sirius is the brightest star in our night sky, and it is an A-type star. Our star, the Sun, is a G-type. Proxima Centauri, the closest star to our solar system, is a faint M-type red dwarf. Returning to Aldebaran, the star is slightly variable, but the change in brightness is imperceptible to the human eye. Aldebaran is one of the few very bright stars that can be occulted or hidden by the Moon. One of these events was observed from Athens in 1509, and during his tenure in the 1700s, astronomer Royal Edmund Halley realised that Aldebaran could not have been in its current position for this to have happened. This means that Aldebaran must have moved over the intervening 1,200 years by about one quarter of the diameter of the Moon. Halley then went on to discover that a number of other stars had also moved in their positions since historical times. These shifting of the star positions is due to all the stars, including our star, the Sun, moving around the galaxy in their own orbit. The nearby stars show the greatest amount of movement. Every 50 years, updated star atlases are released to account for this movement. From our solar system, we will see over many thousand years the stars shift. The constellations we see today will look different in 100,000 or a million years' time. The stars in the Hyades cluster are about 150 light years away from us and consist of at least 130 stars brighter than ninth magnitude. There are a number of double and multiple stars in this cluster. It has used up or lost the interstellar material from which it formed and now it travels as a loose open cluster and is estimated to be about 700 million years old. Almost due north is the zodiac constellation of Cancer the Crab, which appears as four stars with a beehive cluster in the centre. Rising up in the eastern sky is the planet Saturn, appearing as a bright yellow star in the constellation of Virgo. Through a telescope, the rings will appear as a thin disk around the planet. The rings are almost edge-on at this time. In the southern sky, we see the Cross and Echina opposite each other and about halfway up our southern sky. The halfway point between the two marks the south celestial pole. A further way back from Echina, we find the two Magellanic Clouds, two dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way. There are 14 known dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way. It is thought that these galaxies are formed during the birth of their parent galaxy or following interaction with other large galaxies. The tidal forces in these interactions stimulate the collapse of material in the halo of a galaxy, and this leads to the dwarf galaxies forming. One of these is located in the constellation of Canis Major and is known as the Canis Major Dwarf Galaxy, and is about 25,000 light years away from our solar system. This dwarf galaxy is being pulled apart by the gravitational pull of our own galaxy. Recent studies of the globular clusters M79, NGC 1851 and NGC 2808 implies that they may have been stolen from this dwarf galaxy. Another disruptive dwarf galaxy was recently discovered by a team led by New Zealand astronomer Mary Williams. This galaxy is in the direction of the constellation of Aquarius. The region with the greatest number of globular clusters is the Scorpius-Sagittarius region, which is rising after midnight. For those up in the early morning, the planet Venus will rise in the east around 4 a.m. and on the 1st of March, the crescent moon will be close by to Venus. The other planets, Mercury, Mars and Jupiter, are too close to the Sun to be observed. Thank you very much for listening to our Jodcast in the Carter Observatory here in Wellington, New Zealand.